Welcome to episode 1475 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Matthew turned from his own story to the tragedy of Judas Iscariot. Rather than portraying Judas as an obvious villain, he remembered him as a capable, intelligent, trusted disciple. A man who managed the common purse and appeared, for much of Jesus' ministry, to share the faith and hopes of the others. Matthew also confessed that he recognized something of himself in Judas. Having once lived by the calculations of wealth and security, he understood the subtle drift by which money ceases to be a tool and quietly becomes a master. Yet, whereas Matthew walked away from the tax table and allowed his gifts to be redeemed for God's kingdom, Judas remained bound to the habits of the table. The invitation of Christ remained open until the very end, even to the disciple who would betray him. The final question was never whether Jesus was willing to forgive Judas, but whether Judas would remain long enough to receive the forgiveness that was still being offered. Today, we wrap up the stories of Matthew and Judas, narrated by Matthew. Acts of the Apostles, Part 5, Chapter 5.
30 pieces of silver. I am a man who has handled a great deal of money in my life, and I want to tell you what 30 pieces of silver actually was, not as a moral statement, as an accounting fact. 30 shekels was the price set in the law of Moses for a slave who had been gored by an ox, compensation paid to the slave's owner for the loss of property. It was also, more specifically, the amount specified in the book of Zechariah as the wage thrown to the potter, the insulting payment flung at a shepherd who had tended God's flock and been dismissed. Zechariah called it, with bitter irony, the handsome price at which they priced me. 30 pieces, the price of a slave, the insulting wage of a dismissed shepherd. The amount the chief priests counted out into Judas's hands in exchange for knowing when and where they could take Jesus without a crowd. I have recorded this in my gospel. I am the only one who records the specific amount. I noticed it. A man who spent his career at a table knows that numbers carry meaning, and this number carries the weight of every insult the tradition could load into a price. The chief priests went to Judas. I want to say that carefully. They went to him. The initiative came from their side. This does not exonerate Judas. He did not have to receive them. He did not have to name a price. He did not have to lead the soldiers to Gethsemane. But it matters that the corruption had help, that the structures of power, sensing a threat, reached toward the weak point and applied pressure. What was the weak point? The same thing it always is when power buys a betrayal, the thing the person most wants that the movement cannot give him. I do not know what Judas wanted. I have my suspicions, and I will share them. But I want to be careful here because I have seen too many accounts of Judas that claim certainty about his inner life that no one has earned. What I know is what I saw. A man who had managed money for 3 years, who had watched it flow through his hands into needs and ministries and the sustaining of other people, who had felt the pull of the drift I described in the last episode, and who, at some point in that 3rd year, made a decision. My suspicion is that the decision did not feel, in the moment, like a betrayal. I think Judas had convinced himself by then that Jesus was not going where Judas had hoped he was going, that the kingdom talk was not going to produce the restoration of Israel that anyone had reason to expect, that the march toward Jerusalem was a march toward disaster, and that perhaps forcing the situation, putting Jesus in the hands of the authorities, making the confrontation happen, would produce the intervention, the power, the vindication that Judas believed was available, but that Jesus seemed reluctant to claim. I may be wrong. I am offering the reading of a man who knew him, not a verdict. What I know is the result. He led them to Gethsemane. He greeted Jesus with a kiss, the greeting of a student for his teacher, the gesture of respect and closeness, and the soldiers took him. When Judas saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind. He felt remorse, he regretted, but regret and repentance are different transactions. Regret says, I wish I had not done this. Repentance says, I am becoming someone who would not do this. One is about the outcome, the other is about the self. Judas went back to the chief priests with the 30 pieces. He said, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." They said, "What is that to us? See to it yourself." And he threw the coins down in the temple and went out and hanged himself. I have sat with this for a long time. There is something in it that reaches me at the level where the accounting instinct lives. The coins returned. The transaction voided, or attempted to be voided, as if you could undo the deal by giving back the payment. You cannot. This is the thing about certain transactions that the accountant in me understands and the man in me finds devastating. Some exchanges cannot be reversed by returning the goods. The harm is done in the doing, not in the keeping. The 30 pieces, once exchanged, had already accomplished what they were paid to accomplish. Throwing them back at the priests did not unaccomplish it. What Judas needed was not a return. It was what Peter had on the shore beside the charcoal fire. A question asked three times, a commission, a reason to remain. Peter denied Jesus three times and was restored. Judas betrayed Jesus once and was not. The difference is not in the severity of the act. I'm not sure betrayal is more severe than three denials shouted into a courtyard fire. The difference is in what came after. Peter received restoration. Judas did not wait for it. After I finished the gospel, I left. That is the simple version. The longer version is that Jerusalem became increasingly dangerous for the movement in those years. The tension between the community of Jesus' followers and the religious establishment had been building since Pentecost, and what happened to James should have been a warning to all of us who remained. I went where the work needed doing, carrying the gospel I had written. I set out in this story to tell you about the price of following. I told you what I paid, the table, the community, the identity organized around a particular kind of power. I told you what I received, forgiveness, a new community, the accountant's mind redeemed for a different ledger. I told you about Judas, who he was, what I recognized in him, what the drift looks like when it is not interrupted. Now, I want to close the account. The price of following is real. It costs the thing at the center of your life, as I said before. That is a genuine cost, and I do not minimize it. But the price of not following, the price of staying at the table or returning to it, or pricing the gift rather than receiving it, that price is also real, and it is paid in a different currency. Not in the giving up of what you had, but in the not receiving of what was offered. Not in the loss of the old thing, but in the forfeiture of the new. Judas had 3 years inside the most extraordinary life ever lived. He heard the Sermon on the Mount. He watched the feeding of the 5,000. He was in the upper room when Jesus washed feet and broke bread. He had more exposure to the gift than almost any human being in history, and he priced it at 30 pieces. I had spent years at a table extracting money from people who could not afford to refuse me. I had organized my entire life around the logic of extraction, taking from others what they owed to power, and when the invitation came, I left it. Not because I was better than Judas, because something in the two words, "follow me," reached the place underneath the accountant and spoke to whoever was living there, and that person got up and walked away from the table. I'm not sure I can explain that. I have been trying to explain it for 20 years in a gospel, and I am not sure I have fully managed it. What I can say is this: the invitation is still open. It was open for Judas right up until the moment he closed it. It is open for everyone in this account who has never been inside a locked room in Jerusalem or on a hillside in Galilee or at a table where 30 pieces were counted out. The price of following is everything you are. The price of not following is everything you could have been. I chose. Judas chose. The choosing is the whole of it.
Some early writers suggest Matthew died peacefully after a long life of ministry, while later church traditions describe him as a martyr who was killed while celebrating the Eucharist or preaching the gospel. Unlike the deaths of Peter or James, the historical evidence is uncertain. What remains consistent across the traditions is that Matthew, the former tax collector who once served Rome's treasury, spent the rest of his life serving a different king, faithfully proclaiming the Messiah whose invitation had transformed him forever. This has been Acts of the Apostles, Part 5, Matthew the Tax Collector. The story of a man who counted the cost of everything and discovered that the only transaction worth making was the one that cost him everything he had. And the story of a man who sat at the same table, heard the same invitation, managed the same purse, and chose differently. Both stories are true. Both are necessary. The gift is only visible against the cost of refusing it. Follow me.